Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Rudeness and Civility, a conversation about American manners, this week on Soundings. My guest is John Casson. John Casson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John Casson's new book is Rudeness and Civility, Manners in 19th Century Urban America, published last summer by Hill and Wang. Here is John Casson.
19th century manners developed out of older courtesies and courtesy books from a European tradition and in many ways in a rank-ordered society. What they did was to adapt them to make those, to broaden and generalize those notions and to make them more acceptable for a democratic audience. Mm-hmm. Older notions of manners highly prized authority. They spoke a good deal about deferring to one's betters, and the discrimination of one's superiors and one's inferiors was a central part of those notions.
This is the great chain of being idea, the notion of the pyramid or authority flowing from the top down?
There were certainly notions that society was highly hierarchical, that one had a place in it. That could be, for many people, perhaps a secure notion. They knew where they fit. They knew their place. And what the terms of American life from the colonial period on were terms that offer new opportunities for individual self-advancement, of course. That was part of the promise of American life. And to acquire the manners of one's betters, the manners of the gentry, was one way to move upward in society.
So social mobility is certainly nothing new to the yuppies. It's not new to the social demographers today.
No. No, and just as yuppies sometimes take crash courses in how to eat and conduct a business meal, those who've grown up eating McDonald's. So in the early 19th century, in mid-19th century, there were people who wanted to learn how to conduct themselves, people who wanted to move ahead, or people who wanted to avoid embarrassment, would do so by turning to books of etiquette as well as other sources to learn the new manners.
Who did the determining? Give me a very general sense of how manners shape themselves from the top down, from the bottom up. I mean, what are the edges of the envelope here when you try to figure these pressures out?
It's hard, of course, to establish who directs or determines manners. They aren't plots hatched in private. They certainly aren't decided over the dinner table or with demitasse. They, in many respects, the 19th century manners were based upon older forms of manners from courtesy books and other sources, but those were generalized, they were made accessible to a broader public, and I think we have to say indispensable importance was an urban middle class in shaping 19th century manners.
Now, you use a word just now, John Casson, the public. The 19th century is important to you in that regard, the idea of a public defining itself, being defined by intellectual and commercial interests. Talk to me for a couple of minutes about that.
Sure. And we might say in many respects one of the problems of the 19th century is how do we define a public and what is the nature of the public in a democracy. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, I see the importance of manners as a kind of mediating force between the needs of a democratic polity and the demands of a commercial capitalist economy. In a commercial capitalist economy, one has opportunities, one also has inequities. In a democracy, one has to have, to some extent, participation by a broad public. One also has to define in various ways and shape what the responsibilities of that public are.
Does this make of your book, John Casson, an economic history of the 19th century? I mean, how powerful was money?
Money was very powerful. Money has always been powerful. Mm-hmm. My book is an economic history, but my book is about, in some respects, the deep tensions between commercial forces and democratic forces in American society, and how, and it's one of the cliches has been to say that class is the dirty secret of American life. And if right. class is the dirty secret, we might say manners becomes the laundry soap of that. That is to say, right. in many respects, a lot of economic issues are redefined in terms of issues of appropriate behavior, of taste. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier, and we still tend to object to people on questions of taste rather on questions of economic and class background.
Give me as concrete a sense of this as you can now.
There were a good many European visitors to America in the early 19th century coming with their own prejudices, particularly from England. But again and again, what English visitors like Charles Dickens, Harriet Martineau, sure. Francis Trollope, various others will remark upon is the way in which Americans eat and what strikes them as a kind of democratic free-for-all at the table. First of all, we might say that entertainments, including dining, is much more sex segregated than it is today. Men often eat apart from women. Men have evening entertainments apart from women. It tends to be much more segregated in that respect. Also, visitors remark again and again how fast Americans eat. They seem to devour their food. Mm-hmm. And they also, very strikingly, use their forks to hold the food while it's cut, but eat by spearing, say, a piece of meat and putting it in their mouth with their knives. The forks are two-pronged forks. They're really, in many ways, like cooking forks. Uh-huh. They don't use those in their mouths. They eat with their knives. And Dickens and others say this seems to them like sword swallowing.
Tell me about all the place settings and all the utensils. There's a part in your book here, Rudeness and Manners, where you have wonderful photographs of these goodness, I mean, what, dozens, it seems like, sorts of utensils that people would use in the course of a single meal.
Sure. Well, let me lead up to that in some respects, if I may.
Fair enough.
In the early 19th century, Americans eat faster. They eat with great haste. They eat in what seems to be an unregulated way. Mm-hmm. They also don't have meals of courses, but all the food is put on the table at once.
Common bowl, isn't that it?
And in a less simple house, there are some people who are still eating off wooden food, wooden trenchers, mm-hmm. rather than china plates, eating with iron implements and steel implements rather than silver. And it seems to, in many respects, they're eating in ways that go back to 18th, 17th, even 16th century times.
Pretty rough stuff, in other words.
They can be pretty rough stuff. It can be certainly quite rustic. In the course of the 19th century, not everyone will change, but increasingly an urban middle-class standard is set, such that by the time of the post-Civil War period, meals will be served in courses. Mm-hmm. They will be served by waiters. All the food will be prepared and carved in the kitchen. Let me give you an idea of what a typical formal dinner would require in, say, the 1870s or the 1880s. It would begin typically with raw oysters and champagne. Then a waiter would offer a choice of a white or brown soup and pour sherry. Then would come fish with chablis. Then would follow an entree, such as asparagus or sweet corn. Then a slice of the roast with claret or champagne. Now perhaps some Roman punch, which was a watery ice made of lemon juice, sugar, beaten egg whites, and rum, which would freshen the palate for the courses still to come. These would include games such as canvasback duck with Madeira or port, salad, cheese, pastry or pudding, ices, and sweet dishes. Then liqueurs, then fruit, such as grapes, peaches, pears, accompanied by sherry or claret, and then waiters would pass nuts, raisins, sugar plums, and candied ginger. Our ancestors, who would go through this formal Victorian meal, in other words, would consume an enormous meal, but what kept that from a kind of gross display of appetite was the way in which they would exercise certain rituals of refinement, this kind of highly wrought sense of table manners.
Now, when did Weight Watchers begin? I can imagine all of these people weighing, what, 200 or 300 pounds apiece. Obviously, they all didn't. Give me, again, a concrete sense of this, this sense of the propriety of what happened at the table. I remember, for example, in your book, John Casson, people ate as though they weren't eating.
That's right.
Have I got that right?
People were told that they should not comment upon the food in front of them. They did not, they were instructed by the etiquette books that they simply did not make a fuss over the food. They were to play down, in a sense, their actual bodily enjoyment, to pretend, in a sense, that they were not truly eating.
Tell me about the city. You say that looking at the city, that this is important in understanding how manners worked and how they were shaped. You use the semiotics of everyday life. Will you explain that to me, please?
Sure. One of the day-to-day problems that people in 19th century city dwellers had was how to make sense of the urban scene around them and how to interpret the people they met in the city. If you were in a smaller face-to-face society, it's easy to know people or to establish where they fit. You can know them personally, or if you were in a more class-differentiated society, a more traditional hierarchical society, it's easy to recognize people, to pigeonhole them by the way they walk, by the way they dress, by the way they express deference, and so on. One of the central adjustments of 19th century urban life, and this was true in Western Europe as well as in the United States, was how to read the behavior and character of others in what was increasingly an anonymous commercial urban setting.
We have a number of prominent novels in the 19th century about this very problem. I mean, maybe not exercises in sociology, but novels that illustrate this tension between the individual, the one and the many.
Absolutely. Novelists are fascinated by this topic. They're fascinated by the problem of how to read character in the city. Dickens, of course, has wonderful descriptions of this, and in fact how people's character and behavior and demeanor change from one setting to another. Mm-hmm. There's a great scene in where one of his characters, Wemmick, in Great Expectations, whole face changes as he walks from home back to his office. And his face assumes, I believe it says, Dickens says his mouth assumes the character of a mailbox by the time he gets back to the city. American writers were similarly fascinated by this problem of reading character in the city. Edgar Allan Poe writes a marvelous short story called The Man of the Crowd, which is a kind of virtuoso exercise in how to read a character from appearances.
You also discuss Herman Melville's wonderful little story, Bartleby the Shrivener. Now, I always took that as an indictment of a criticism of civil disobedience. You read it in terms of manners. You have a character here who goes to work for an attorney, and he's famous for, what is his line? I would prefer not to.
Yes. Melville writes this wonderful short story, Bartleby the Scrivener. A scrivener is a copyist long before the age of photoduplication machines.
Much less word processors.
And what the story does, in many respects, is test what are the obligations one person has to another in a commercial urban setting.
Well, this ends up on a very not just a pessimistic note, on a note of despair and death.
Yes, indeed.
Now, what is Melville saying about manners in the 19th century in that regard?
Well, the story is saying a great many things. The reason Bartleby has been such a fascinating story, it's been called Melville's most perfect short story, mm-hmm. and the reason it is so fascinating, it's attracted so many commentators, is because it goes to the heart of so many issues of life in America in the mid-19th century. And one can read it in a number of different ways. And finally, of course, what this story, this rich and wonderful story, does is have Bartleby, as one character, more and more refusing to copy, refusing to read copy, refusing to do any duties, but refusing to leave the office, finally refusing to live. Mm-hmm. He dies in the New York prison, which was called the Tombs.
Right.
The lawyer can do nothing for him at the end, and the story ends, in many respects, as a story of the lawyer's despair, his attempt to reach Bartleby, when finally the various other relationships are discarded to reach Bartleby as a fellow human being. And to say, in effect, there are bonds he has toward Bartleby which go beyond all the bonds of a utilitarian society, all the bonds simply of a cash economy. Mm-hmm. And this goes beyond, this is a civility which goes far beyond etiquette books. It's the ultimate sense of what responsibility do we have for other people? Because again and again, it's emphasized in the etiquette literature, and in novels and in much of life, how private life is a rehearsal for public life.
Well, speaking of rehearsals, talk to me for a few minutes, John Casson, about this section of your book called The Disciplining of Spectatorship. The audience was in charge.
The audience had a much more powerful role. The audience did not defer to the authority of the conductor, to the authority of the actors, to the authority of the managers, and anywhere near the way we've come to expect.
We had an instant ratings service at work here. Is that right?
A good description of this is by the English writer Francis Trollope, who was in the United States in the 1830s. Francis Trollope tells a wonderful story about how she would see in the front row of a dress box, as she put it, a lady performing the most maternal office possible, that is to say, nursing her baby. Gentlemen were wearing their hats, but shedding their jackets, and rolling up their shirt sleeves, sprawling grotesquely in their seats, throwing up their legs over the boxes, and stinking of onions, whiskey, chewing tobacco, and spitting incessantly.
Oh, goodness.
And she tells one story about a man in the pit, the area right in front of the stage, who was seized with a violent fit of vomiting. And far from other people trying to ignore this, as we would come to expect it, they started laughing about it, were intensely amused. And one of the actors on stage, seeing this going on right in front of him, and he was playing the role of a doctor, decided to ad lib the line, "I see my services are wanted elsewhere." And the audience loved this. So there was this kind of interplay between audience and actors, audience and performers, that was very different than what would be established later. If audiences liked a performance, they would not simply clap politely, they would stamp their feet, they would shout, and they would say encore, which meant not we want another performance at the end, but an immediate repetition of the song or the bit that they had just seen. And if an audience didn't like a performance, they thought nothing of shouting it down, of calling for something else instead, of shouting performers from the stage, and of throwing things. Not simply fruit, but in some cases throwing coins.
Other people.
even throwing. The most extraordinary case was the Astor Place riot of 1849, which came out of this rivalry between
two actors,
the American actor Edwin Forrest and the British actor William Charles MacCready. The theater in the early 19th century was much more a theater which was inclusive of working class people as well as middle class
people. Shakespeare was the most popular, isn't that what you say?
And Shakespeare was the most popular performer. We might say in some respects that the American theater of the earlier 19th century had powerful resemblances, in fact, to the Elizabethan theater.
Yeah.
Just as in Shakespeare's own day, the theater played to a broad audience, which often reacted exuberantly to it. And there are, of course, all sorts of references in Shakespeare's plays to the audience responses. Yeah. So in the 1830s, 40s in the United States, we see a similar kind of audience. And Shakespeare was hugely popular as a playwright. Mm-hmm. People knew Shakespeare in an extraordinary way. He was not highbrow entertainment at this time. He was popular entertainment.
John, let me stop you for a moment. Tell me about Theodore Thomas, this man who shapes manners deliberately. I mean, there's nothing unconscious about this. Have I got it right?
That's right. Theodore Thomas was a conductor and one of the leading conductors of his generation, which is to say the period from the 1860s to the turn of the century. He's conductor first for various New York orchestras, then for the Chicago Symphony. Thomas was remarkable because, among other things, in the critical period of transition, Thomas consistently defended the authority of the conductor against the audience.
Now, he didn't invent it, but he certainly embodied it. Have I got that right?
Thomas embodied a standard of musical authority, and he used that to also demand for the conductor his social authority.
All right, what did he do? Give me this quickly, this story, when he stands up and reads the riot act to the audience one night.
Well, there was one performance in which Thomas was in the 1860s giving a performance in New York City of Liszt's Mephisto Waltz, and the audience didn't like that, and the audience started showing how they didn't like it in their traditional ways. They started howling, whistling, and hissing. Twice Thomas stopped the music until calm resumed, and then he began again. The third time he was interrupted, he turned, faced the audience, took his watch in his hand, and announced, in this marvelous way he had, "I will give you 5 minutes to leave the hall. Then we shall play this waltz from the beginning to the end. Whomever wishes to listen without making a noise may do so. I ask all others to go out. I will carry out my purpose if I have to stand here until 2 o'clock in the morning. I have plenty of time." And the story is that the audience submitted to Thomas's assertions of authority and made no further protest. Thomas was able to silence any audience, and he would do this repeatedly.
Can you imagine something like that happening today in a movie theater, if you turn around and say, "I will give everybody 5 minutes to shut up so I can enjoy this film"? It just doesn't happen, does it?
It's difficult for an individual patron to do that. There are, of course, still examples, and we now accept the authority of a conductor. Yeah. So if a conductor stands up today, and it's usually not necessary, but conductors have, from that time, insisted upon their authority. Thomas was, in effect, part of that generation who established the conductor's authority to do this.
John, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Your book is Rudeness and Civility. Are we a rude or are we a civil society?
I think rudeness and civility are things very much like beauty in the eye of the beholder. And we are fascinated by, I think we have today a very divided attitude toward our own manners. On the one hand, we like to see ourselves as an informal and relaxed society. Increasingly, we're a society where everyone is on a first-name basis.
That wonderful line in your book about how everybody in California, bank tellers, that first-name intimacy, that instant intimacy.
That instant intimacy is very much a part of our culture. Uh-huh. We see people as very much, we want to be relaxed and informal. On the other hand, we are offended by rudeness. And the point, I guess, I would make that comes out of my work in the 19th century is that, in fact, there's not a one-to-one relationship between manners and the political and social relationships of society, but manners reflect political and social relationships. And in the course of the 19th century, many of the bases, the benchmarks, if you will, the standards by which we judge manners today were established. We are now, in many respects, a more informal society. But we would not tolerate the kind of behavior at a concert that was customary in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. We've much more come to accept the kind of standard established in the late 19th century. We would not feel comfortable in a restaurant if people ate the way they did routinely in the 1830s and 40s. We've come to accept the standards of late 19th century table manners. Today also, it strikes me that the debates about manners are also, in some respects, debates about class and ways of contending for a space and a voice in society. In the mid-19th century, in the Astor Place riot of 1849, that was, among other things, a battle between working class people and upper middle class people about who controlled the theater, who controlled the expressive space of the theater. Today, if a black teenager carries a boombox down the street in a white neighborhood, and the neighbors criticize him about this or say that that is rude, they are in many ways, in fact, arguing about symbolic space and about the use of that space.
Rather than a particular kind of music.
Yes. In Spike Lee's movie, Do the Right Thing, a movie in which a riot comes out of, among other things, the use of a boombox, the playing of a radio in an Italian pizzeria, takes us back, I think, to the 19th century. We see that issue as being very much an issue only of our time. I would suggest that although the terms are different, the larger stakes are very much the same.
John Casson, what have you learned personally about manners? Do you think of yourself as a better mannered individual having written this book, Rudeness and Civility, the way you're raising your kids, the way you talk to your colleagues, that sort of thing?
I think that this book is not, doing the research for this book did not change my own manners a great deal. I think it gave me even more sensitivity to all the issues involved in a question that seems to be merely, in quotes, a question about manners. I also think that in some respects my children suffered because of this book. It was hard to read books of manners all day and then come home to a household with two young children and to overlook the normal and understandable deviations from the highest 19th century Victorian standard of table deportment.
John Casson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program is Soundings. This is Wine Pond at the National Humanities Center. John Casson's new book is Rudeness and Civility, Manners in 19th Century Urban America, which was published last summer by Hill and Wang. Soundings on Rudeness and Civility is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 530. That's program number 530. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip once again, 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, the topic will be revolutionary observers. My guests will include Melvin Richter of the City University of New York, Nikita Pokrovsky of Moscow State University, and Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Happy birthday to America's first official record keeper. Charles Thompson was born in late November of 1729. Thompson served as Secretary of the First Continental Congress. This week brings us the anniversary of the Articles of Peace between Great Britain and the United States, which ended America's War of Independence and which were signed at Paris in late November of 1782. Birthdays this week include the writers Samuel Langhorne Clemens, Louisa May Alcott, and Jonathan Swift, the poets William Blake and Philip Sidney, the industrialist Andrew Carnegie, the inspirational author Dale Carnegie, the social reformer Carrie Nation, the baseball player Joe DiMaggio, the musicians Virgil Thompson and Chuck Mangione, the first female surgeon in the United States Army, Mary Walker Edwards, the suffragist and prison reform leader Wendell Phillips, the women's rights advocate Sarah Grimke, and the abolitionist Sojourner Truth. Finally, this week marks an anniversary for the Tehran Conference of late November and early December 1943, when leaders from the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union met to determine a plan for the Allied assault against the Nazis in Western Europe. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Rudeness and Civility, a conversation about American manners this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a discussion featuring John Casson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John Casson's new book is Rudeness and Civility, Manners in 19th Century Urban America. Rudeness and Civility, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.